Matt Bodine felt some familiar stirrings inside him. He and Sam had been in Sweet Apple for several weeks now. Most of the time in their travels, they stayed in a town for only a few days, a week at most. Their only lengthy sojourns had been when they returned to Montana to visit their families. Other than that, they had stayed on the move more often than not. So when Matt felt the wanderlust growing within him, he knew what it was. As he sat behind the marshal's desk in Seymour's office and tipped his chair back, rocking it a little with a booted foot against the desk, he looked across the room at Sam.
I've been thinking.
We can't leave.
I didn't say we should.
No, but when you get to thinking, that's usually what it's about. Either that or some pretty girl.
I do like to think about pretty girls, but you're right. That's not what I was thinking about.
Do you really believe that Seymour's capable of handling things here by himself?
We didn't sign on to be permanent wet nurses. Besides, he stood up for himself just fine in that big fight with those owl hoots.
With our help. And now he has to worry about a full-scale war breaking out between Double C and Pax.
Aw, Jesse and Sandy's daddies will settle all that in court.
Do you really believe that?
I'd like to believe it.
So would I, but I don't.
No, neither do I, if you come right down to it. Those two old pelicans are too used to getting their own way. Neither one of them will back down, no matter what some judges or lawyers say.
That's what I think, too. So I don't believe it would be a good idea for us to leave right now.
So what do? We have to leave sometime.
Maybe we should tell Seymour to start looking around for some permanent full-time deputies. Maybe if he could find a couple of good men who actually wanted the job, and if the town council will agree to pay their wages...
Now you're talking. I don't really want to go off and leave Seymour in a bad spot, but I've started to get a hankering to ride out to California.
California? What's in California?
We won't know till we get there, will we? That's sort of the whole point, ain't it?
Where are you going?
I thought I'd go get some supper. Want to come along?
No, I'll hold down the fort here until you or Seymour gets back.
Don't hold your breath waiting for Seymour. He was having supper with that little school marm of his. They'll probably go for a walk afterward, maybe do a little sparking. I didn't expect him back until late.
That's all right. Best of luck to him.
Matt left the marshal's office and turned toward the cafe, still thinking about California.
Shit!
Matt broke into a run toward the sounds of battle. Drawing his Colt as he did so, he saw spurts of orange flame in the gloom up ahead. One of the combatants was to his left, two more to his right behind a parked wagon. The man to Matt's left was lying on the ground. Matt suspected that he'd been bushwhacked by the two men behind the wagon. That was how setups like this usually played out. Then, with a shock of recognition, he realized that the house behind the little yard where the lone man lay belonged to Maggie O'Ryan. Seymour had been headed here earlier. Was he the one who had been ambushed? That guess was confirmed a second later when the door of the house opened, spilling light from inside.
Maggie, no! Get back inside!
Matt recognized Seymour's voice. Standish must have been hit. That cinched it. Matt knew who the bad hombres were here and veered to the right so that he could get a shot at the men using the wagon for cover. They must have heard his boots slapping against the dusty street because one of them suddenly whirled. Something slammed against Matt's right foot and knocked that leg out from under him as he ran. Matt came to a stop on his belly with the revolver still in his hand. Seymour was still firing from Maggie's yard. Facing threats from two different directions now, the would-be killers broke and ran. The men disappeared into the Stygian darkness of the alley. Matt pushed himself to his feet. His right foot was numb. He didn't know if he was hit or not, but when he tried to take a step, he almost fell, barely catching himself before he sprawled in the dirt again. Matt didn't feel any blood leaking into his boot. He limped over to the wagon, which was the closest thing he could grab onto and use to steady himself. When he lifted his right foot and examined the boot, he saw that the heel had been shot away. His foot was numb from the impact of the bullet, but otherwise unharmed.
Seymour! Seymour, are you all right?
The door burst open again, and this time Maggie wasn't going to be sent back inside. Now that the shooting was over, she rushed out.
dear Lord, you can't be dead!
I'm not.
Matt and Maggie reached Seymour at the same time and knelt on either side of him.
Where are you hit?
I don't believe I am.
Well, you grunted. I thought one of them had winged you.
No, a bullet hit the ground quite near my face and threw dirt in my eyes. It was rather painful, and for a moment I couldn't see anything. But it's getting better now.
Maggie threw her arms around Seymour and hugged him tightly.
Oh, thank God you're all right.
Matt heard more running footsteps and straightened, thinking that the bushwhackers might be coming back after all.
Over here, Sam.
What happened? Is everybody all right?
A couple of varmints bushwhacked Seymour.
As he turned back toward the marshal, he saw that Maggie had helped Seymour to his feet and was still standing there close beside him, with one arm around him.
You sure you're not hurt, Seymour?
I'm fine.
Tell us exactly what happened.
I can tell you that. The bushwhackers were hiding behind the wagon over there, and then they threw down on Seymour when he came out of Miss Orion's place.
Well, it wasn't exactly that way.
How was it then?
Those men were lying in wait for me when I came back down the walk, true. But they weren't behind the wagon. They walked toward me as bold as brass and started to shoot.
How come you're not ventilated?
When I saw them in the shadows, some instinct, I suppose you'd say, warned me. I crouched down and leaped to the side just as they opened fire. Then I lay down on the ground, pulled my gun, and returned their fire. Perhaps we should go inside. I don't think those scoundrels will be back, but if they were to return, we make awfully tempting targets out here in the light.
You're right as rain, Seymour.
Matt looked towards Maggie.
That is, if it's all right with you, Miss Orion.
Of course, of course. Come in. Seymour, you sure you're all right?
Indeed, I am.
Once they were all inside Maggie's house with the door closed and the curtains pulled, Seymour continued his story.
I suppose they thought they could just walk up and shoot me. They weren't expecting me to fight back. Or at least, they didn't act as if they were expecting it. Once I'd fired a couple of rounds, they turned and ran behind that wagon to continue their assault. Luckily, the light was poor, and I suppose that threw their aim off.
The fact that you was throwing lead right back at them might have had something to do with it, too.
Did you get a good look at them?
Not at all. They were never anything but two shadowy figures. I couldn't tell you how tall they were or how they were dressed or anything of that sort.
Who'd want to kill you?
I have no idea. I don't have any real enemies that I know of in Sweet Apple. I had several encounters with various gunmen right after I came to town. Cole Halliday, Jack Keller, and Ned Aiken all threatened to shoot me at one time or another. But those disputes have all been put behind us. If you recall, they fought side by side with us against Mallory and El Casario.
I remember. It's not likely any of those three would try to ambush you like that. If they decided they wanted to kill you, they'd do it out in the open, where it would help their reputation as gunslingers.
Really? You really think it would help their reputations as gunslingers to kill me?
Well, I didn't really mean it like that.
When I first came to Sweet Apple, the only reason they didn't shoot me was because they thought that it might harm their reputations. I'd say I've come up in the world.
Land's sake, Seymour! You sound like you want those men gunning for you.
No, not at all. It's just nice to think that I'm not completely an object of scorn and ridicule anymore.
Let's get back to those hombres who ambushed you.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's a total mystery to me.
Yeah, me too. But we'll probably have another chance to figure it out.
What do you mean?
Those fellows wanted you dead. Since you're still drawing breath, there's a pretty good chance that sooner or later they're going to try again to kill you. But in the meantime, sleep tight.
Rebecca Jimerson, wrapped in a silk dressing gown, poured cognac from a crystal decanter into a snifter. On the other side of the hotel room, Cornelia Standish sat in a wing chair, smoking a cigar, and reading the latest edition of the Sweet Apple Gazette.
What a pitiful excuse for journalism. But then, what else can you expect in a frontier backwater like this?
Sweet Apple has its advantages. No one knows us out here except Seymour, so you don't have to sneak around to see me. You don't have to act as if you're ashamed of me the way you do back in New Jersey.
I don't do that. See who that is.
When Rebecca opened the door, she saw the smooth-faced, reptilian-eyed Warren Welch standing there, holding his hat in one hand in front of him.
McCracken and Stover weren't with him. Without waiting for Welch to say anything, Rebecca stepped back and motioned for him to come in. For appearance's sake, Standish had his own room across the hall. But it was here to Rebecca's room that Welch had come looking for him. Everyone knew what she was, Rebecca thought. Even this cold-blooded killer.
Well?
McCracken has a bullet hole in his arm. Stover's patching it up now. We didn't figure it'd be a good idea to go to the local doctor with a bullet wound. If there even is a doctor in this godforsaken place.
That was smart thinking. I suppose McCracken must have been shot by accident while you were taking care of Seymour?
No, he was wounded by that gunslinging nephew of yours.
What the devil are you talking about?
I thought he was supposed to be an incompetent fool. That's the way you described him to us.
That's the way he's always been. He can barely keep from falling over his own feet, and he's frightened of his own shadow.
He's changed since he came out here, remember?
I don't believe what I read in the newspapers about Seymour. Reporters make those things up just to sell papers.
Well, I'm not making this up. McCracken and I followed your nephew this evening as planned and ambushed him when he was leaving a house on the edge of town. It should have been a simple job, but he spotted us and moved like greased lightning. We missed with our first shots and he returned our fire.
Seymour did that?
That's right. We had to take cover behind a wagon that was parked nearby. McCracken was hit while we were doing that. Then before we could take care of your nephew, somebody else came running up and started shooting at us.
Who?
I don't know. Some cowboy. One of Seymour's newfound friends, I suppose. Or just somebody you couldn't resist a fight.
Where was Stover while this was going on?
He was close by. He was going to circle around, try to get a shot at your nephew from behind. But once that other gunman showed up, we decided it would be better to withdraw and try again later.
So all you really succeeded in doing was to warn Seymour that someone is after him.
If you had given us an accurate picture of what we were facing, we would have handled the job differently. This is going to take more planning. Seymour's a dangerous man and he has friends. But we'll get him. Don't you worry about that.
Seymour? A dangerous man?
For her part, Rebecca found herself both surprised and thrilled to hear that Seymour was still alive. He hadn't just survived the ambush attempt by his uncle's hired killers. He had fought back and wounded one of them. Rebecca never would have dreamed that such a thing was possible. Why, if Seymour Standish could actually grow a backbone and demonstrate some skill with a gun, then anything was possible. Even, perhaps, Rebecca turning her back on the money and all the other creature comforts that her relationship with Cornelius Standish provided. It was something to think about. The little farming village some miles south of the border dozed in the pre-dawn hours. Soon, the women would rise and begin preparing breakfast. In most of the huts, the meal would be a meager one, for this was a poor village. The soil in the foothills of the mountains that loomed over the community was rocky, and crops grew there only grudgingly. The men would stumble from their bunks and eat, then trudge to the fields with a step that was already weary. Yet for all its hardships, life still held a few joys. A golden sky at sunset, a breeze to cool the heat of the day, the laugh of a child, the warmth of a woman's body, an occasional nip from a jug of pulque or tequila. These things allowed a man to tolerate all the less than pleasant aspects of life. So their continued existence was precious to the men of the village, and because of that, they did as they were told when the riders came thundering down out of the mountains, galloping into the village with torches blazing in their hands. Guns blasted into the air, and sleepy-eyed men, women, and children hurried out of their homes, only to be herded together and forced to the village plaza by men who appeared to be giants when they were mounted on tall horses. The strangers wore broad-brimmed, steeple-crowned sombreros and carried weapons that gleamed in the flickering torchlight. In the entire village, there were only a handful of firearms, most of them ancient shotguns that might not even shoot anymore. The men were farmers, not fighters. Their hands were curved to fit hoes and shovels, not gun butts. The leader of the invaders was a big, barrel-chested man with a black beard. Just behind him rode a lean, hawk-faced man with a thread of mustache on his thin upper lip. The people of the village recognized both men. The leader was Diego Alcazario, the famous revolutionary whose goal was to overthrow the dictatorship of the evil Presidente Diaz. His whippet-like companion was Florio Cruz, Altazario's second in command. Of course, everyone in the village also knew that revolutionary was really just another word for bandido, and the struggle against El Presidente's rule was merely an excuse for Altazario and his men to do whatever they pleased and take whatever they wanted. But no one was going to come right out and say that, especially not with Altazario right there to punish anyone unwise enough to do such a foolish thing. Life, with all its hardships, was still better than death, after all. Much better than the sort of slow, agonizing death that Altazario would provide for his enemies if he chose to do so. For a time, little had been seen or heard of the revolutionaries. It was said that they had ventured across the border into Texas on some sort of quest for modern repeating rifles. If so, they had failed. They had returned to Mexico bloodied and beaten. Even Diego Altazario himself had suffered serious wounds at the hands of the hated gringos. There was talk that he might die. But obviously he had not, because here he was, as big and strong as ever, and as the citizens of the village huddled together in the plaza and waited to see what he wanted, Altazario rode his big, beautiful horse back and forth in the torchlight in front of them.
Amigos, I have come to help you. In my generosity, I bring you an opportunity for greatness. Join me, and together we will strike a blow for freedom and justice. Join me, and we will throw off the yoke of the oppressor. We will bring fear to the hearts of the gringos. And when that evil bastard Diaz hears of our exploits, he will tremble and take to his bed in Mexico City. Join me in seeking vengeance on all who have wronged us. I have guns and horses, but I need men to use them to help in the great struggle against those who would oppress us. Join me in this noble cause, my friends.
Several of the younger men from the village stepped forward. Riderless horses were led forward for the new recruits. They were given rifles, old single-shot weapons for the most part. They could arm themselves better from the loot of the next raid. Building and equipping an army was a slow process. With a curt motion of his hand, Altazario signaled for the riders to turn and head back up into the hills. They thundered away, torches bobbing in the pre-dawn gloom. The bandidos were gone, this time. But they would be back. The villagers were certain of that. Sooner or later, evil always came back.
I simply can't figure out for the life of me why anyone would do such a thing.
For the life he is, just about right, Seymour. Next time, they might not miss.
I know.
Seymour stood up and reached for his hat.
Well, I have to go over to the hotel and see my uncle. He'll soon be sending out those new salesmen of his, and I owe it to him to give them as many tips as I can on covering the territory.
Your uncle? Your uncle's here in Sweet Apple?
With new salesmen?
That's right. Oh, didn't I mention that to you? Uncle Cornelius arrived on the train yesterday afternoon, along with his secretary and three men who will be taking over as representatives of the Standish Dry Goods Company here in West Texas.
So it takes three men to replace you, eh, Seymour?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to actually say that. I didn't set up all that many accounts before I resigned from the company to take the job of marshal. But West Texas is a big sales territory.
It's just big, period.
So I'm not surprised that Uncle Cornelius has expanded his sales force. What is a little surprising is that he came out here to supervise them himself. He's not really the sort of man to be comfortable on the frontier.
Not like you, eh?
Oh, I'll be the first to admit that I didn't fit in here at first. But this is my home now, and I intend to spend the rest of my life here.
Well, keep your eyes open, and maybe that life will be a mite longer.
Surely no one will try to kill me in broad daylight.
Probably not, but you never know. Just be careful, that's all.
I intend to. I promise you.
We gonna follow him and keep an eye on him?
Give him a minute. We don't want him to think that we believe that he can't take care of himself. Does it seem a little funny to you that Seymour's uncle shows up yesterday afternoon? And then last night somebody tries to kill him?
Why in blazes would Seymour's own uncle want to kill him?
I don't know. Probably one thing doesn't have anything to do with the other. It was just an odd coincidence, that's all.
And I reckon that's all it was. Maybe those bushwhackers were planning on robbing the bank or something like that, and they wanted to get the local law out of the way first.
Maybe. Let's go make sure Seymour gets to the hotel all right.
Matt and Sam stepped out of the marshal's office and looked toward the hotel. Seymour had almost reached the building. He nodded and smiled to the townspeople he passed. Seymour disappeared into the hotel. Matt and Sam looked at each other and shrugged. As long as Seymour was in there, he ought to be safe. With a friendly nod to the desk clerk, Seymour started up the stairs to the hotel's second floor, where his uncle's room was located, along with the rooms rented for Rebecca Jimerson and the three salesmen. Only one of the men, Warren Welch, struck Seymour as being the right sort to be a successful salesman. Daniel McCracken was too sullen, and Ed Stover too big and bear-like and intimidating. But he supposed he could be wrong about them. The only true measure of success was results, and Seymour wished them all luck. He would do what he could to help them. He owed his uncle that much. Reaching the second floor landing, Seymour turned and started toward his uncle's room. Seymour started to whirl around as alarm bells went off in his mind. The other attempt on his life was too recent for him to have forgotten it. His hand stabbed toward the butt of his gun.
Oh, Seymour, what's wrong?
Oh, I'm sorry, Miss Jimerson. I didn't mean to startle you.
Oh, you did more than startle me. For a second there, I thought you were going to draw your gun and shoot me.
Oh, I would never do that. You have my sincerest apologies. It's just that, well, I'm sure you haven't heard about it, but last night some miscreants attempted to shoot me.
No! What sort of terrible place is this, Seymour?
It's not terrible at all. It's just different from New Jersey. Very different.
Evidently. Are you looking for your uncle?
That's right. I thought I would talk to him and those new salesmen. Perhaps I can give them some advice that might prove useful in expanding the business of Standish Dry Goods here in West Texas.
That's very generous of you. But that can wait. I want you to come with me and tell me all about everything that's happened to you since you got here. From what I've heard, it's a very exciting tale.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Oh, don't be so modest, Seymour. Now, come along and talk to me.
Well, I suppose we could go downstairs and sit in the lobby.
We'll go to my room.
Oh, I don't know. That wouldn't really be appropriate, would it, Miss Jimerson?
Oh, for God's sake, Seymour, we've known each other for years. You can call me Rebecca. And you don't have to worry about being alone with me in my hotel room. I won't attack you or anything.
Seymour had never really been able to argue successfully with a woman, especially an attractive, assertive one like Rebecca. He found himself walking down the hotel corridor at her side.
You see, Seymour, you're perfectly safe. After all, you're the marshal of Sweet Apple now, and if I cause any trouble, you can always arrest me. You could handcuff me and put me behind bars.
I could never do that, Miss Jimerson. Rebecca.
I might not mind. I'm sure you wouldn't do anything to me that I didn't deserve.
You want to hear about everything that's happened to me since I came to Sweet Apple?
That's right. Tell me all about it, Seymour.
Seymour did, leaving out some of the more gruesome details of the gun battles in which he'd been involved, but not sparing himself any of the humiliation he had experienced early on, when he had been known as Seymour the Lily-Livered and the most cowardly man in the West.
Oh, how dare people treat you so badly? They had no right to say those things.
They had every right. Respect has to be earned, and I did nothing to earn it. Not until I met Matt and Sam.
Matt and Sam?
My deputies. Well, unofficial deputies. Matt Bodine and Sam Two Wolves.
Seymour told her about the Blood Brothers and how they had come to Sweet Apple on the trail of Deuce Mallory and the rest of the gang that had raided a town up in the Texas Panhandle while Matt and Sam were there. He also mentioned briefly some of the other dangerous exploits Matt and Sam had taken part in during their adventurous career.
They sound quite dashing.
I'll be happy to introduce you to them.
No, that's all right. I'd be glad to meet them, but don't go out of your way to arrange an introduction, Seymour. The real reason I came out here with Mr. Standish was to see you.
Me? Why would you want to see me? I mean, I know we were cordial enough back in New Jersey, but...
Seymour, don't you understand? Don't you know how I feel about you? How I've always felt about you ever since we met?
Seymour's head had begun to spin. It seemed to explode right off his shoulders as she came up on her toes and pressed her lips to his in a passionate kiss. Seymour's pulse hammered like a drum in his head as he finally managed to pull away from her. Kissing Rebecca was wrong, completely wrong, and he knew it. And yet, her lips had been so soft and sweet and warm.
What's wrong, Seymour? Haven't you ever been kissed before?
Of course I've been kissed, but not like I mean...
Not like that, I'd wager.
No, not like that.
You just don't give yourself enough credit, Seymour. You never have. You don't see what a handsome, desirable man you really are. Now that we're being truthful, how do you feel about me, Seymour? Have I wasted my time coming out here to see you? Or is there a chance that there might be a reason for me to stay when your uncle goes back east?
I'm sorry, but there's someone else.
Someone else?
Her name is Maggie. Miss Magdalena Elena Luisa Orion, to be precise. She's a school teacher. A wonderful young woman. You'd like her, you really would.
I'm sure.
So you see, it's really not appropriate for me to be here, with you, for more than one reason.
Well, I wouldn't want you to do anything inappropriate, Seymour. You should go ahead with the errand that brought you here. Go talk to your uncle.
All right, I'll do that. I'm sorry, Rebecca, Miss Jemerson. It wasn't my intention to hurt your feelings.
Hurt my feelings? What in heaven's name makes you think you've hurt my feelings? I was just trying to be polite to you, Seymour. You seem so awkward and out of place here. I thought your spirits could do with some lifting. That's all.
Oh, well, I'm glad you're all right.
Oh, I am more than all right. I'm fine. Just fine.
Good. I suppose I'll see you later.
Rebecca gave a non-committal shrug of her shoulders, as if the question of whether or not they would see each other again meant nothing to her. Less than nothing, in fact. Seymour reached behind him and fumbled for the doorknob.
I'll never understand women.
The bitter taste of defeat filled Rebecca's mouth. Rage seethed inside her. Some of it was directed at Seymour. How dare he reject her like that? Did he think she was really interested in hearing about his frumpy little schoolteacher? Was he really that foolish? Well, if that was the way Seymour wanted it, then whatever happened from here on out was on his own head. Standish needed to know about those two drifting gunfighters who had befriended Seymour, because it was likely they would have to be disposed of too, somewhere along the way. Otherwise, they might protect Seymour from any more attempts on his life. At the very least, they had to be decoyed, distracted, gotten out of the way. She would tell Standish about it, Rebecca decided, as soon as Seymour got through talking to him. His uncle Cornelius didn't seem particularly happy to see him, Seymour thought, when Standish opened the door of the hotel room. Seymour thought that Welch, McCracken, and Stover might be here, but Standish seemed to be alone.
Hello, Uncle Cornelius. How are you this morning?
Is it always this hot out here? It was stifling last night. There wasn't even a breath of fresh air.
I don't really know. I haven't been out here long enough to become familiar with the climate, but I suspect it is rather warm most of the time.
What do you want?
Well, I thought I'd come talk to you about establishing a sales territory out here in West Texas. I might be able to give some pointers to your new salesman.
That's not necessary. They have plenty of experience at what they do. I'm sure they'll be fine.
Really? I wouldn't mind.
Forget it, Seymour. You made your decision. You have your job as marshal to take care of. You should concentrate on that.
I'm sorry if you were disappointed by my resignation. This new life of mine, it's just something that I have to do.
Fine, fine. Now, if you don't mind, I have some work to do.
Of course. But if anything comes up that I can help with...
I'll be sure to let you know. Good day, Seymour.
Seymour looked at Standish for a moment longer, gave a quick nod, and walked down the stairs out of the hotel. Standish was about to close his door when he noticed Rebecca standing in the hallway.
What do you want?
Aren't you going to ask me in?
Fine, fine.
Seymour came to see me.
He just left here. What did he want with you?
He was telling me all about his life here. Have you heard of Matt Bodine and Sam Two Wolves?
The names sound familiar for some reason.
They were probably mentioned in those newspaper stories about Seymour. They're gunmen, adventurers who drift around the West looking for trouble.
That's right. Seymour's deputies.
Not officially. The town isn't paying them anything, and they don't wear badges. But they've befriended him, and they're helping him keep law and order here.
It must have been one of them who ran up and interrupted Welch and McCracken yesterday evening.
That's what I thought, too. It's going to be difficult to get rid of Seymour as long as those two are around Cornelius.
What do you suggest we do? Kill Bodine and Two Wolves, too?
A fine chance those men of yours would have doing that. They're gunfighters, and they know the West much better than any of us ever will. If you send Welch, McCracken, and Stover after Bodine and Two Wolves, all three of them will probably wind up dead. What you really need to do is come up with some sort of distraction so that you can move against Seymour while his friends aren't around.
Perhaps what I should have done was to kill Seymour myself while he was just here.
But you don't do your dirty work yourself, do you, Cornelius?
Don't underestimate me, my dear. Not even you know everything that I'm truly capable of.
If you'd killed him, what would you have done with the body? And for all we know, Seymour told Bodine and Two Wolves that he was coming to see you. You might have fallen under suspicion if he had disappeared.
That's certainly true. It's best that we bide our time and wait for the right moment. And as you said, that's a great deal more likely to come along if we can separate him somehow from his friends. I'll discuss it with Welch and the others.
Good luck. And as far as I'm concerned, the sooner we get out of this godforsaken place and return to actual civilization, the better.
Don't hurry off.
I thought you were angry with me.
I can never stay angry with you for very long, my dear.
Standish pushed her honey blonde hair aside and kissed the back of her neck.
Are you sure this is a good idea?
Standish's hand slipped down from her shoulders and began to roam over her body, exploring and caressing her curves.
It's always a good idea. That is, unless you don't want to.
Of course I want to. Don't I always want to?
One thought rang clarion clear in Rebecca's mind as he kissed her.
Damn you, Seymour Standish. Damn you to hell for turning me away and giving me no choice. It's your own fault you have to die.
The judge and Martha had ruled that until the legal dispute between Shad Colton and Esau Paxton could be ironed out, Colton would have to leave the creek between the two spreads unfenced. That decision had infuriated Colton, but he respected the law. Although the posts that had already been put up were left standing, no more were erected, and the barbed wire remained unstrung. But that didn't mean he had to let his rival's cows drink freely from the stream. The two double C hands were named Rusty and Bill. One tall, one short, both were bearded old-timers who had ridden for Shad Colton for many years. Of course, for a lot of that time, they had worked for Esau Paxton, too, when the two ranches were one. But they had gone with Colton when the spread split, and their loyalty was to him. Today, they had been sent out to patrol the creek. Their orders were simple. If they spotted any Pax cows drinking from the stream, They were to fire their rifles into the air over the animals' heads and haze them away from the water, staying on Double C range as they did so. No damn judge could argue with that, Colton insisted. So Rusty and Bill would do what the boss said, even though they were a mite uneasy about it. These patrols along the creek had been going on for several days, and surely Paxton and his boys had gotten wind of them by now.
Now, Pax ain't gonna let this stand. Now, say what you will about him, he's a cattle man. He won't let his cows go thirsty.
But you heard Shad. The creek is his by right.
Well, maybe so, but I still got a bad feeling about this.
The two cowboys came in sight of the creek and turned their horses so they were riding parallel to the line of trees that marked the course of the stream. They hadn't gone very far when Rusty reined in, stood up in his stirrups, and pointed.
Shit! Look over there!
Several dark shapes that could be glimpsed through the trees were obviously cows. Rusty put his horse into a run toward the creek. Bill followed. By the time they got there, at least a dozen cattle had crowded along the far side of the creek, water splashing around their hooves as they dipped their muzzles into the stream. The Pax brands burned into their hides were clearly visible, even in the sun-dappled shade under the trees.
Those are definitely Pax cows. You heard the boss's orders, and we can shoot over their heads and holler all we want, but that's all.
Yeah, I know.
Rusty raised his rifle into the air. When the shot rang out, Bill thought for a second that Rusty had fired. But then he realized almost instantly that the sound came from somewhere across the creek, not on this side.
Rusty! What the hell happened?
I'm shot! Son of a...
Bill stared down at Rusty and saw the blood on the front of his shirt. Bill quickly raised his rifle. Bill's carbine went flying into the air as he fell. Bill's wounded shoulder didn't hurt too bad yet. It was numb right now rather than painful. He rolled onto his side and reached across his body with his left arm since his right wouldn't work anymore. Awkwardly, he drew his pistol and then lurched to his feet.
Come on, you sons of bitches!
The thirsty ground soaked up the two cowboys' blood so that it didn't run into the creek. After a while, the powder smoke drifted away and the cattle returned to drink, although not without casting wary glances at the two corpses sprawled on the opposite bank. Matt and Sam were coming out of one of the stores in Sweet Apple when they heard the swift pounding of hoofbeats. They swung around to see who was riding so hurriedly into the settlement. Matt stiffened in alarm as he recognized the trim shape of the rider and the long red hair that had escaped from a Stetson. The hat dangled from its chin strap at the back of Jesse Colton's head.
Jesse, what in blazes is wrong?
Two of my pa's riders were killed out by the creek, shot down from ambush. He thinks Paxton men did it. He's gonna ride against Pax.
Ah, damn it. I knew this would happen if your pa kept Paxton's cattle away from that creek. Of course Paxton would fight back.
Maybe it wasn't Paxton's men.
Who else had any reason to do a thing like that? Jesse, you say he's gonna attack Paxton's spread?
He was gathering up the men when I threw a saddle on this horse and headed for town. I figured you and Sam were the only ones who might be able to stop him.
Two of us against a couple of dozen fighting ranch hands?
Matt, you've got to try. Otherwise, you know what's gonna happen.
A bloodbath.
Hell. All right. We've got to at least try to stop it.
I want to come with you. My father...
We'll do our best to see that he doesn't get his fool hide ventilated. But your horse is played out. He couldn't keep up with us.
Seymour was sitting behind the desk of his office, his chair leaned back and a booted foot propped against the desk. He sat up hurriedly and got to his feet when he saw that Jesse was visibly upset.
Miss Colton, what's wrong?
Matt and Sam are on their way out to Pax. I thought I'd let you know, Marshal, even though they didn't tell me to.
Has there been more trouble?
Grimly, Jesse filled him in on what had happened at the creek and her father's reaction to the murder of two of his riders.
Matt and Sam headed for Pax, hell-bent for leather. If anybody can head off a gun battle, it's them. I hope.
I should follow them. But my jurisdiction, my responsibilities lie here in town.
No offense, Marshal, but I don't figure there's much you can handle that those two can't.
I certainly can't argue about that. I suppose they'd want me to stay here and keep an eye on things in town.
That's your job. Anyway, I'm going to PAX. They're saddling a fresh horse for me right now, down at the livery stable.
I'm not sure that's such a good idea. There may be shooting, and I don't think Matt and Sam would want you to endanger yourself.
I don't care. My father's in danger, and I'm not going to stand by and do nothing if there's a chance I can help him. I've got a rifle, and I'm a darn good shot.
Miss Colton, I urge you very strongly not to go out there. I know that if Matt and Sam were here, they would tell you the same thing.
I'm sorry, Marshal.
Miss Colton!
Seymour lifted a hand, but Jesse ignored him and turned to stalk out of the Marshal's office.
Blast it!
Seymour had just left his office when he felt a tug on his sleeve and looked down in surprise. A small boy stood there. He'd come up without Seymour noticing him.
Hey, you're the Marshal, ain't you? Some man told me to fetch you. He gave me a nickel and told me to tell you to come down to the old barn at the west end of town.
Seymour knew the barn the boy was talking about. It was a ramshackle patchwork affair, built partially of adobe and partially of stone and wood, with a thatched roof that sagged as if it were in danger of collapsing. Seymour didn't know how long the barn had been sitting there empty and unused, but it looked as if it had been abandoned for several years at least.
You're sure the man didn't say whether or not something was wrong?
No, just that it was important you come down there as soon as you can.
Very well.
I'm going to go buy some candy with my nickel.
You do that.
The barn sat by itself, a short distance from any of the other buildings on the outskirts of the settlement. It was next to what remained of the foundation of another larger building. Seymour had no idea what it had been, but he suspected that the barn and the adjacent structure had been some of the first buildings in Sweet Apple. Seymour strode up to the doorway of the barn.
Hello? It's Marshal Standish!
Seymour stepped into the barn.
Hello? Is anyone here? This is Marshal Standish! Please, speak up if you can!
Just as a precaution, Seymour reached for the gun on his hip. His fingers had just touched the Colt's ivory grips when something dropped over his head. Matt and Sam expected to hear the sharp reports of gunfire as they approached the headquarters of Esau Paxton's ranch, but so far, the afternoon air was still, heavy with heat, but quiet. They hadn't been to PAX before, but had a fairly good idea where the ranch house was located. With the unerring instincts of true frontiersmen, they rode straight toward it.
Maybe we're going to beat Colton and his men there.
It's going to be close. Look there!
Matt grimaced as he saw the cloud of dust rising in the air. It took a lot of horses to kick up that much dust. Unfortunately, it was between the Blood Brothers and the ranch. The Blood Brothers leaned forward in their saddles and urged more speed from their horses. The dust cloud grew closer. Colton and his men weren't wasting any time closing in on PAX, but they didn't know that possible trouble was coming up behind them. Matt and Sam caught sight of a large group of riders sweeping down a long, shallow valley toward the PAX ranch house, which was a sprawling adobe structure in the Spanish style, with red tile roofs on its wings that surrounded a central courtyard. A bunkhouse and other outbuildings were scattered around beyond it. The Double C men spread out into a line and reined to a halt about 100 yards from the PAX ranch house. A burly figure on horseback detached himself from the rest of the group and rode forward alone, stopping when he was about halfway between the rest of his bunch and the house. Matt recognized Shad Colton. He had to give the man credit for having plenty of sand. Colton had put himself out in front where he would serve as a tempting target if any shooting broke out. Several of Colton's men heard Matt and Sam coming and wheeled around, drawing their guns as they did so.
Hold your fire! We're not Paxton men!
Colton ignored the disturbance behind him. Raising himself in his stirrups, he bellowed toward the house.
Paxton! Come on out here and face me, you backstabbing murderer! You hear me, Paxton?
The front door of the ranch house opened. Matt and Sam were close enough now to see that every window in the place had a rifle barrel protruding from it. The house was bristling with Winchesters. The tall, lean figure of Esau Paxton stepped out, cradling a rifle in his arms.
What are you doing over here, Colton? You know you're not welcome on this ranch.
I've come for justice. Two of my men were murdered earlier today, shot down from ambush while they were doing their jobs. But I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, am I, Paxton?
Are you saying that I had your men bushwhacked?
Damn right that's what I'm saying. Give me the man who pulled the triggers, Paxton, or by God, I'll wipe you and yours right off the face of the earth.
I don't know what you're talking about, Shad. I give you my word of honor, I didn't have anything to do with bushwhacking any of your men.
The shots came from Pax Rage.
That doesn't mean Pax Riders fired them.
Matt turned to Sam.
How about that? Paxton's actually trying to be reasonable.
You believe him?
He sounds to me like he's telling the truth. And anybody could have hidden in that clump of mesquite and gunned down those double C cowboys.
That's my thinking exactly. Come on, let's see if we can keep those two old pelicans talking sense.
Sam hitched his horse into motion, riding forward despite the ominous looks of warning from the double C punchers. Ignoring the guns pointed at him, Matt rode after Sam. At the sound of the horses coming up behind him, Shad Colton hipped around in the saddle. He scowled as he recognized Matt and Sam.
What the hell do you want?
I'm trying to keep you from getting yourself shot full of holes. I don't care all that much myself, but I know a certain red-headed gal who'd be mighty broken up about it if you were to get yourself killed, Colton.
Jesse, by God, that gal has to stick her nose into everything.
You should be glad of that, Mr. Colton. She didn't want you to do something foolish, like come over here and attack your cousin's ranch.
Two of my men are dead.
Yeah, but what proof do you have that Paxton's responsible?
The shots came from his side of the creek.
And as Mr. Paxton told you, anyone could have hidden on Paxton's range and shot your men. You need more proof than that for the law.
I don't need any more law than what I've got right here in my holster. That was plenty when we came out here, wasn't it?
Shadrach stopped short as he realized that he was about to ask his cousin a question concerning their shared past. With the current hostility between them, Colton obviously didn't want to bring up a time when they had been more than relatives. They had been friends and partners as well.
No, anyway, I don't care about the law, and you two don't have any authority out here. You don't work for the county sheriff or the Texas Rangers. That dude in town who calls himself a marshal don't mean squat out here on the range.
Maybe not, but we still don't want to see you or anyone else hurt or killed in a senseless battle.
Defending yourself ain't senseless. Settling the score for two men who were gunned down in cold blood ain't senseless.
It is if you're not sure you're going after the men who were really responsible.
Can you prove that Paxton wasn't responsible for Rusty and Bill getting killed?
Hey, Paxton! Has anybody been messing around that clump of mesquite where the bushwhackers were hidden?
This is the first I've heard about it, so I'm fairly confident that none of my men have been over there today.
One of my riders looked the place over, found horse tracks and some shell casings. I don't reckon anybody's been there since then.
Then let us take a ride over there and have a look around. Maybe we can find something that will lead us to the real killers.
You and your men go back to the double C, Colton. Maybe we're not the law, but we're the closest thing to it in these parts right now. Let us investigate before you start a shooting war.
If there's proof that Paxton is behind what happened to your men, we'll find it. Then you can let the law take its course.
You won't find any proof because there isn't any. Because I didn't have anything to do with those double C men being ambushed. For God's sake, Shad, you ought to know me better than that.
I thought I knew you. You proved me wrong a while back.
There's no point in bringing all that up again.
Damn right. You showed your true colors, and there ain't no going back. There ain't much of anything I'd put past you now, Paxton. Your men have fought with mine before.
Hot-headed cowboys at a dance. That's a lot different than lying in wait and gunning down men from hiding.
Colton, are you going to let us take a look, or do you start killing each other for no good reason?
Oh, go ahead and have a look at the place where it happened. But if you find any evidence pointing to Paxton and don't tell me about it, then you two are going on my list too.
We're just after the truth.
Which is that I and my men had nothing to do with this. We've been falsely accused, and I won't forget that.
Turn around and ride back to your ranches. Take all your men with you.
We'll go. But we'll be back once you find out I'm right about this snake-blooded bastard!
I won't be talked about like that on my own land. Get moving, Colton, or I won't be responsible for what happens.
And I won't be ordered around by the likes of you!
Despite the talk, Colton turned his horse and lifted a hand to signal to his men.
Move out, boys! We're heading back to the ranch!
What about Rusty and Bill? Ain't we gonna settle up for them?
Damn right we will. Just not right now. Those two hombres are gonna take a look around and find proof that Paxton's to blame for what happened. Then we'll see to it that justice is done. You got my word on that?
The Double C riders didn't like it, but they turned their horses around and rode away with Colton, leading them back toward the neighboring ranch. Matt and Sam didn't relax until Colton's bunch was several hundred yards away. They were still within rifle range, but a battle was unlikely to break out now. The door of the ranch house opened again, and Sandy Paxton came running out, her blonde hair flying in the breeze. Even though the showdown had been averted, at least for the time being, she still wore a frightened look on her pretty face. Sam swung down to meet her, and she threw herself into his arms, hugging him tightly as she ignored her father's look of disapproval.
Thank God you and Matt got here when you did, Sam. I thought sure Pa and Uncle Shad were going to try to kill each other.
That man's not your uncle. It's bad enough he's a second cousin.
He was like an uncle to me when I was growing up, and you know it, Pa. The same way that you were like an uncle to Jesse.
I haven't tried to break up your friendship with Jesse, but you don't have to throw it in my face either. And for God's sake, girl, stop hugging this man. He's practically a stranger.
Aren't you going to call him a half-breed, too?
You said that, not me. I thought you two were going to ride over to the creek and have a look at the site of the killings.
That's right. You still say you didn't have anything to do with what happened, Paxton?
I most certainly do. I didn't even know any of Colton's men had been bushwhacked until he rode up and started snorting and pawing like a mad bull.
We'll see what we can find out.
But if the trail leads here, we'll be back.
It won't.
The Blood Brothers turned their horses and headed west, leaving father and daughter standing there side by side in front of the ranch house.
You think Paxton's telling the truth?
I don't know. Even if he is, some of his men still could have ambushed Colton's men.
I hope we can find out one way or the other.
The killings had occurred not far from the spot where the previous confrontation between Double C and Pax had taken place. Matt and Sam found it without too much trouble. The bodies of the two slain cowboys had been taken back to the ranch headquarters, but their blood was still splashed on the grass along the creek bank. On the other side of the stream, about 50 yards away, was the clump of mesquite Matt and Sam had heard so much about. They dismounted and left their horses a short distance away from the mesquite, not wanting the mounts to disturb any tracks that might have been left by the killers. They found a set of prints leading from the creek to the clump of scrubby trees.
Those were made by the Double C hand who discovered the bodies.
Sam nodded in agreement. Another set of tracks entered the mesquite from the far side, then departed the same way. A lone rider. There had been only one bushwhacker. Whoever he was, he handled a rifle with enough skill so that he was confident of being able to kill two men. Sam knelt by the hoof prints and studied them for a long time, taking note of every nick and scratch in the iron of the horseshoes.
I might be able to pick out the tracks if I saw them again.
Let's see where they go. We know they start off toward Paxton's headquarters, but that doesn't mean they keep going in that direction.
Sam started to straighten, but he stopped suddenly and then reached under one of the mesquites. He picked up a small brown object that had been almost blended in with a scattering of rocks about the same size.
What's that? Some sort of animal dropping?
Smells almost that bad. But that's not what it is. It's part of a cigar. The bushwhacker must have bit it off and spit it out here.
A cigar, eh? The hombre's not very smart. He left a cigar butt, shell casings, and hoof prints behind him. It's almost like he wanted us to track him.
Let's see what else we can find.
No other bits of evidence were anywhere around the mesquites. The Blood Brothers mounted up again and followed the tracks that led toward Paxton's headquarters. After a couple of miles, the trail hit a rocky stretch and disappeared.
Reckon he rode through there on purpose?
Yes. Maybe he's not quite as clumsy as we thought. He laid the trail he wanted to lay, pointing right at Paxton. Now he's headed somewhere else.
Sam turned his paint toward the south.
He'd circle in this direction if he was going back to town.
Why would anybody in Sweet Apple want to stir up trouble between Double C and Pax?
I don't know.
But it got us out of town in a hurry, didn't it?
Damn it! Seymour's back there by himself!
As the noose tightened around Seymour's neck, he felt himself jerked off his feet. He kicked wildly as he rose into the air. His fingers clawed at the rope as it dug into his flesh, but he couldn't get any purchase on it. Black and red starbursts exploded behind his eyes. Seymour was convinced he was going to die here. He would never see Maggie Orion again, never get a chance to realize any of the dreams that he had begun to have about making a life together with her. Without his weight pulling all the slack out of the rope, Seymour was able to work the fingers of one hand under it and pull desperately. Seymour heard a rush of footsteps and kicked a foot against the ground, rolling over as he continued to try to pull the rope away from his neck even more. As Seymour saw a pair of shadowy figures charging toward him from the depths of the deserted barn, he jerked the gun from its holster and angled the barrel upward. Seymour finally tore the noose off his neck. Seymour was able to see well enough to know that the two shapes had turned and were headed for the back of the old barn. Seymour saw splinters fly from one of the beams around the rear door as the men ducked through the opening and disappeared. He struggled to his feet. Seymour stumbled toward the rectangle of light that marked the front door of the barn. He emerged into the late afternoon sun. Seymour's vision cleared enough for him to make out several of Sweet Apple's citizens hurrying toward him, drawn by the sound of shots.
Marshal, what the hell happened? You all right?
I'm not hurt.
What in blazes happened to your neck? You look like you've been strung up.
That's just about what happened, all right.
Seymour didn't think the assassins would try again, not with this many people around. Seymour turned and started back into the barn. The citizens followed him. Inside, once his eyes adjusted to the dim light again, he saw two pieces of a broken beam hanging down from the ceiling, their ends jagged and splintered where they had been broken. From where the rope lay, Seymour knew that it had been looped over that beam and then dropped around his neck. Then the two men had hauled him up off his feet to let him dangle there until he died. The plan might have worked, too, if the beam hadn't broken under his weight. What if it hadn't? Seymour looked around and spotted an old, rickety, three-legged stool lying next to the wall on its side. If he had died at the end of that rope, his killers could have tied it off, set the stool next to his dangling body, and made it look like he had hanged himself. Of course, he never would have done such a thing, but did anybody in Sweet Apple know him well enough to have been certain that suicide simply wasn't in his nature? A shiver went through Seymour at that thought. Whoever wanted him dead was clearly willing to go to any lengths to accomplish that end. From now on, he would have to be more careful than ever, since he had no idea who'd been trying to kill him.
I don't want to hear any more excuses. This is twice you've attempted to do the job I'm paying you for, and twice you've failed miserably. I'm starting to believe that you three aren't the right men for the job.
Warren Welch, Daniel McCracken, and Ed Stover glared back at Standish. They didn't like having their abilities challenged that way. They prided themselves on being efficient killers.
Well, maybe we tried to get a little too fancy. That beam seemed strong enough to support Seymour's weight when Ed tested it.
Hey, don't blame this on me, Welch. It was your idea to make it look like the kid hung himself.
I did my part. I killed those two cowboys and got Bodied and Two Wolves out of town so you'd have a clear shot at Seymour.
Stop bickering, all of you! That's not accomplishing anything. I don't care whether it looks like an accident, or suicide, or divine intervention. Just make sure that little bastard dies.
He probably won't set foot out of his office again without his pet gunfighters with him. Now that's going to make it more difficult.
Would a $3,000 bonus make it worth the risk?
You mean over and above what you already promised to pay us?
That's right. You'll all get your fee, but the man who actually kills Seymour will collect an additional $3,000.
That's a lot of money.
That's why I expect results.
You'll get them.
And soon, damn it. The sooner I get out of this hellhole of a town, the better.
By the time Matt and Sam got back to Sweet Apple, the settlement was still buzzing about the latest attempt on Seymour's life. Pierre Delacroix, the proprietor of the Black Bull, saw the Blood Brothers riding past the saloon and stepped out onto the boardwalk to hail them.
Monsieur Bodine, Monsieur Two Wolves, have you heard the news?
Not really, but the town seems to be worked up about something.
Did something happen to Seymour?
Is he alive?
Oui. Marshal Stannis is still with us, but not for lack of trying on the part of two assassins a short time ago. I'm not sure whether he was injured. He went into his office and has not emerged since.
Thanks, Delacroix. We'd better see how he's doing.
As Matt and Sam turned their mounts toward the marshal's office, both of them spotted Maggie O'Ryan hurrying along the street toward the same destination. Word must have reached the school of Seymour's mishap, whatever it was. Unable to contain herself and clearly not worried about propriety, Maggie broke into a run. Maggie reached the office door just ahead of Matt and Sam and threw it open, rushing in.
Seymour! Seymour, are you all right?
Matt and Sam were right behind her. They saw Seymour standing up from behind his desk, a rifle in his hands, and a startled look on his face. Maggie was lucky he hadn't fired a shot when she charged in like that, Matt thought.
Maggie!
That was all Seymour had time to say before Maggie threw her arms around him and enveloped him in a tight hug.
Oh! There, there. It's all right, Maggie. I'm not hurt. Well, not too badly, I suppose.
Matt and Sam saw the red line around Seymour's neck.
What happened?
Somebody tried to string me up.
You mean hang you?
That's right.
Quickly, Seymour filled them in on the details of the latest attempt on his life.
The sheer good fortune of that beam breaking is the only reason I'm not dead.
Did you see the hombres?
No, I never got a good look at them. But there were two of them. I'm certain of that. Which makes me think it was probably the same two men who tried to kill me before.
More than likely. Unless there are more folks who want you dead than we know about.
Why? Why would anyone want to hurt you? A lawman makes enemies. It's inevitable, I suppose. But there's nobody around here who holds a real grudge against you. You haven't... Haven't really done anything except fight that one battle against Mallory's gang. And then Alcazario's bandit. Is that what you're trying to say? Oh, Seymour, I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. They're not hurt. You're absolutely right, Maggie. Mallory's gang was wiped out. The survivors from Alcazario's band retreated back across the Rio Grande, and I haven't done anything else as marshal except to break up a few fights and put a drunk or two in jail for the night. That's hardly enough to warrant these repeated attempts on my life.
That's the way we see it, too.
What did you do after you ran those varmints off?
Came back right here. I loaded a rifle and sat down to wait. I'm not sure what I was waiting for, but I wanted to be ready. You sound like it hurts you to talk. It does a little. My throat is rather bruised.
Why don't you go back to the hotel and take it easy for a while? Miss O'Ryan can bring you some supper.
Yes, some nice hot soup to soothe your throat. I'd be happy to do that. I'd like that. Thank you. But I have my duties as marshal to think about.
Don't worry about that. Matt and I will keep an eye on things.
And have a look at that old barn where those fellas jumped you. Never can tell when we might find something that'll tell us who they were.
All right. I suppose that makes sense. After starting to repair my reputation in this town, though, I don't want to do anything to make people think I'm actually cowardly. I don't want them to start calling me Seymour the Lily-Livered again. Anyone who says that around me will be sorry.
Anyway, recovering from an attack isn't cowardly.
And it's not every day a fella gets strung up and lives through it. I reckon folks will understand if you take it easy for a little while.
Come on, we'll walk over there with you, just to make sure nothing else happens.
I'm coming too. As soon as I know you're safe, I'll go fix that soup.
The four of them left the marshal's office together. Matt walked just ahead of Seymour and Maggie, with Sam just behind the couple. When they entered the hotel lobby, they found Cornelius Standish waiting there, pacing anxiously.
There you are, Seymour. What are these rumors I hear about someone trying to kill you again?
I'm afraid they're true, Uncle Cornelius.
They dropped a noose around my neck and tried to hang me.
Dear God, what sort of uncivilized place is this? Perhaps you should come back to New Jersey with me.
No, I'm not going back. Sweet Apple is my home now, and I'm going to stay here.
But you're going to get killed.
I'll just have to run that risk. Besides, there are dangers back in New Jersey, too. I could get run over by a runaway milk wagon or something like that.
Well, I suppose your mind is made up.
Indeed it is. But I appreciate your concern, Uncle Cornelius. To tell you the truth, I didn't know you cared that much.
Of course I care what happens to you. You're family, after all, Seymour.
I'm glad to hear you feel that way. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to go upstairs and rest a bit.
You go right ahead. If there's anything I can do for you, just let me know.
Certainly.
Seymour and Maggie went upstairs, trailed by Matt and Sam. The Blood Brothers didn't turn back until Seymour was safely in his room, with the door open, as he insisted, since Maggie was there. Cornelius Standish was nowhere in sight when Matt and Sam went back downstairs.
Nice fella for an Eastern dude, that Standish.
You think so?
He was mighty worried about Seymour.
Uh-huh.
You're not still thinking that Standish and those new dry goods salesmen of his might have had something to do with those attempts on Seymour's life, are you?
There's no proof of it so far, but I still find it a little coincidental that as soon as they show up in town, somebody starts trying to kill Seymour.
Cole Halliday shot the hell out of Seymour's hat the day he got to Sweet Apple.
Yes, but shooting somebody's hat is a lot different than shooting him.
Matt and Sam walked down the street to the old barn where the latest attack on Seymour had taken place. Inside, they found the broken beam and the rope, just as Seymour had described. Sam picked up the rope, looked at it closely, and ran its rough length through his fingers.
Nothing unusual about it. You could buy a rope like this in any general store in town. It might have even been lying in here, left behind by whoever was the last one to use this barn.
Matt pointed to some marks in the dust.
Those look more like shoe prints than boot prints to me.
I think you're right. That's another piece of evidence implicating Standish and those men who work for him.
Well, maybe. But they're not the only ones in Sweet Apple who wear shoes instead of boots. Anybody who doesn't ride a horse very often, or at all, is liable to wear shoes.
That's true. But if we're talking about a preponderance of evidence...
You're the one using highfalutin college words, not me.
I'm just saying that after a while, things start to pile up and point in a certain direction.
How do you think Seymour's going to react if you go to him and tell him you think his uncle is the one trying to kill him?
He's not going to believe me.
That's right. So I reckon we'd better keep looking until we're sure.
Well, I know one thing. I'm going to be watching Cornelius Standish. The next time trouble strikes, I plan to see where it's coming from.